the Old Testament, the book of Proverbs, chapter 16. I see that with chapter 16 of Proverbs in 1980, we suspended the studies for a break and resumed them exactly a year later. But I don't get the impression this time that we need a change yet, although that doesn't necessarily mean that we go on to the bitter or the glorious end of the book. I certainly don't want to be rigid even in a systematic expository ministry. Actually, there are more themes in this chapter than in several of the chapters we have tackled lately. For example, in the first four verses, verse 9 and verse 33. In these verses, it is the relation of God's overruling providence to the plans of men, which seems to be the theme. God's overruling providence to the plans of men. In 1980, we instanced the soldiers. How well do you know your Old Testament? You need to know it here. We instanced the soldiers of the four kings in Genesis 14, amongst whom Lot dwelt, Sodom and Gomorrah, who were preparing for battle against the five kings from afar. But it was God who gave the victory. And then Abraham at Moriah, laying the fire on the altar upon which he was to sacrifice Isaac. But it was the Lord who prepared a ram for a substitute sacrifice. You see, the Lord works out everything according to his sovereign will, says verse 4. And in doing so, verse 2, he weighs motives. Since this is so, it is better, as in verse 33, to cast the lot into the lap and leave decisions to the Lord. For it is what he ordains for his children, we know, that will come to pass. We see that in verse 9. It is therefore better to commit our way to the Lord in the first place, verse 3, so that there is no clash with the Almighty. For we see in verse 1 that what the heart of man may plan in all good faith turns out to be quite different when the time comes, because the Lord suddenly puts something different on the lips of his servant, even words that he never planned. Would that not make life uncertain, you might ask? Yes. And no, uncertain, because we don't know the whole of God's will for us. Certain, because the Lord is absolutely to be trusted, and our peace is in trusting him who always knows and does best. But then that makes man a dependent creature, and the natural man doesn't like that. He likes to think he is a free agent. But is he? Yes, he is. Yes, he is. For so far from the Almighty manipulating his highest creature, man, there are few things more sure than this, that God never violates man's free will. Never. He has too much respect for man to do that. One of the striking things about Jesus' approach to people is his fundamental respect for them. That's what drew children to him. But not sophisticated types, because he saw through their artifice. What he may do, what the Lord may do, is to work in a man by various means to convince him, and he's prepared to take a long time to do that, years it could be, before he convinces some people. Oh, yes. By various means, he seeks to convince him of what he wants him to do. But it is never manipulation, but always by honorable and rational persuasion. So that no man ever could say that God forced him to do anything against his will. You got that? So honorably great is God's power, and so perfect his will, that he is able to use man's bad will to fulfill his eventual purposes, and always to his praise. For example, men were perfectly free to crucify Jesus Christ, and thought they were acting under their own control. But so great is God's overarching sovereignty that he was able to use their bad will and work to bring Christ through death to immortal and eternal manhood, not only for himself, but for us, his chosen ones. The Almighty didn't frustrate the will of those who sought to destroy Christ, but let them have their way, because it was in his power to use their evil deed for the greatest good that ever accrued to mankind, namely salvation. A most exciting and even ironically amusing example of this is that of Balaam, which I mentioned during the reading, whom Balak, the king of Moab, hired to curse Israel. But all that Balaam could do when he opened his mouth was to bless Israel. What fun! Holy fun! You see, it is this in Numbers and chapters 22, is it 25? This is one of the most entertaining incidents in the whole Bible. Why it hasn't been dramatized or used as an oratorio, Drew, almost, if I dare to say so, a comic opera, I don't know. It could be uproarious. But, you see, so telling of God's overarching power to make the man say the opposite of what he wanted to say. Isn't that fun? Holy fun! What a God! And some people think he's dull. It could only be dull people that think God's dull. Isn't that right? Only dull people could think God dull. Dead people. There is also the case of Jonah, who, although he ran away from God's revealed will, in the end he went to Nineveh, as God had commanded him, and he fulfilled the Lord's will for that people. There is also Jacob, who, with the connivance and the encouragement of his devious mother, Rebekah, purloined what God had promised in his good time. And Jacob had to pay for it by doing 20 years hard labor in a foreign land, ending with a most humiliating but refining experience at Peniel, all for his sins. Chapter 20 and verse 24 says, a man stepped by the Lord. How then can anyone understand his own way? That is to say, how can he understand his own way fully? But the interaction of the divine will with the human will has a lot to do, of course, with man's double disadvantage. You know what man's double disadvantage is vis-a-vis his maker? That he is both a creature and a fallen one at that, so that he is doubly dependent on his maker as creature and as sinner. For there is nothing in the world so hateful to God, as verse 5 says, as a proud man, because the Lord knows how futile it is for man to be proud when he has absolutely nothing to be proud of but his shameful sin. You see, man's view of things and of what is right can be so distorted, as verse 25 says. And if he were allowed to pursue what he thinks is right, it would lead to disaster and death. And he would ultimately see that this was so. What the Lord must do there, in the interest of his child and servant, as any protective parent would do, is to show him the wrongness. Doesn't the Lord show you the wrongness sometimes of what you are intent on? And to do so, he can use a variety of means. Direction can come from different quarters and in different forms, so that the intent child of God may remain humbly open to what the Lord may say. This way or that. But in it all, I'm constantly involved, as is natural amongst young people, with those who are seeking the will of God for their lives. And we may not know, even later on, and youth may not know what the rest of our lives is for. It may be this way, it may be that, and we don't know. But our faith is assured that God will lead us on unerringly into fulfilling his will. No doubt about that. If we lean hard upon him, trust him, however difficult, dark, problematic the way may be, especially at crisis moments and crossroads. If we wait on him, and it's very often a matter of waiting, and waiting is hard for young people, wait on him in the fullness of time. He must. If God doesn't fulfill his promise, then he's no use and should be discarded. But that's impossible. That's fearful, the very thought of it. He must be true to you in respect of your will and your vocation and your marriage, if that's in his will for you. Trust him. Trust what we were saying this morning, that Alan Redpath said to
Mrs. York many years ago, 46, in the music hall, when she said she was she'd been trying for this experience of Christ all her life. And she was a woman in her late 60s, I suppose, then. He said, "Madam, it's not trying, it's trusting." That's a whole world. That's a whole gospel in a nutshell. Isn't it? Now, this is what the Lord did when the Apostle Paul was intent on exploring, you remember, the northern area of Asia Minor, Bithynia. But he was gently jockeyed towards Troas and shown Europe across the water there as needing his attention. Now, this is very interesting. The northern area turned out to be Peter's province, as 1 Peter 1, 1 and 2 say, along with a hint in Acts 16, 6 to 8. Acts 16, 6 to 8 inform us, or give a hint to us, as 1 Peter 1, 1 and 2 says, that Peter was to be involved in the northern province of Asia Minor, now called Turkey, which was called Bithynia. And I would still like to learn, if there are any historians here who have any idea of this, or any, now most of our friends who have been in Turkey have been further south, I think. I don't know that any have been as far north as the shore of the Black Sea, but if anyone had been in this direction, if anyone has been to Armenia here, I want you to come and speak to me. I want to know about the origins of the church in Armenia, the Christian church in Armenia. I want to learn whether it was the effects of Peter's influence in Bithynia, and whether that influence extended further east, and whether it was Peter's missionary endeavors in the north of Asia Minor which led to the founding of the Armenian Christian Church, which still survives. And you would have been hearing news about them and their sufferings the other day in Nagorno-Karabakh. In the midst, this church still survives in the midst of a sea of Islam. Fascinating. God's guidance of Paul and Peter and John, the aged, to Patmos. How fascinating. Now, however uncertain you may be about your ultimate vocation, marriage, if that's to be, aren't you excited to see how marvelously God guided these men? You're not of less importance personally to him than they were. And he will guide you just as unerringly. If there's one thing I'm sure about, it is that if we seek the Lord with all our hearts and wait upon him, he will show us our vocation, and he will lead to the right person to marry, if any. I would not marry a couple unless I had the assurance from them, a passionate assurance full of conviction, that God had brought them together. The only hope of a marriage is that. Only marriages made in heaven by God are bound to last. And there are many sitting here who've lasted for many decades now. We know what we're talking about. We've seen it work out. an experience. Back to the Lord revealing his directive will. Although his will is sovereign, he never allows it to clash with the imperfect will of his saints. Rather, he loves to guide by inclining his child and servant to full consent and cooperation with what he wills. Again, it is the peaceful and gracious persuasion by revealing how good his will really is. It's that by which he leads us. By peaceful and gracious persuasion, he reveals to us how good God's will really is, and for us to follow it. Isn't that great? He has such full respect for his children. Oh, let me stress that. Let me stress that. It's wonderful to feel Jesus' respect for me, even when I feel that I'm not respectable at all. And for him to come and say so kindly to me and to my broken heart, you matter, boy, you matter to me. He has such full respect for his children, even the poorest of them, that he wins them rather than overbears them. But of course, that is how he made us in his image. And he was bound to have respect for his own image. And looking forward, as the Father naturally was, to the time when his perfect image would appear on the earth in the incarnation, the birth of his own Son. Now, you see, you have all this that we've been talking about in verses 1 to 4, 9, 25, and 33. And so sensitive will the Lord's man be to divine direction, that when he errs, his loving fear for his God and Master will be such that he will submit to even the gentlest promptings of the Spirit, so that any sin or fault will be atoned for and evil avoided, as verse 6 says. You see, there are many bonuses to abiding by the Lord's will and committing ourselves to him in it. As verse 3 says, our plans will succeed. Then, as verse 10 and verses 13 to 15 discuss, 10, 13 to 15 discuss to keep in with righteous authority means that we enjoy the King's smile and not his wrath. Yes. We've said so often about the aged saint who had served the Lord a long day ministering his word, and he was so tired when he climbed the stairs to bed that he was too tired even to pray. And that was shocking for him. And he went to the window and looked up and out and said, "Father, it's all right between thee and me, isn't it?" And he lay down and slept sweetly. But from what we read of the corruption in the world today, in the business and financial world, how few aspiring tycoons could ever sleep or sit down at their desks with a clear, clean conscience. The winking of the eye in 30 is an indication of the deviousness of man and of the sheer lack of integrity as far as their fellows are concerned. To do the dirty on another, whether it is an individual or a family or a huge business consortium, is shameful and brings more than red faces to, say, British Airways, and gives opportunities for ambitious men like Branson to gloat. He'd better watch himself. Is he the only modern tycoon to have clean feet? Or is there not a danger, dear man, that men like him, in the end, might need a clean pair of heels like Maxwell? I like verse 31 very much, although it's hardly grey hair which crowns some polished pates. For a man to attain old age righteously is something. And if it is true that his life on the whole can bear scrutiny, which we fervently hope is true of our Prime Minister, that magazine of the prestige of the New Statesman should publish such an unsubstantiated rumor is surely an indication that nothing apparently but the law is going to restrain the snarling, destroying wolves of the press. Nobody is safe if wicked people are allowed to concoct stories. Even the Lothian police seem to have done that. And these rascals of the press are prepared to beg, borrow, or steal scrip with absolutely no compunction whatsoever about printing them. I hope the Prime Minister's libel actions are very successful if there are no grounds for these scurrilous allegations. But you see, if a man can attain old age righteously, that is very wonderful. And the reason would be, of course, as verse 7 says so penetratingly, that when a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, he is not only able to protect him from his enemies, but much more than that, is able to make his enemies be at peace with him. That is even more wonderful, isn't it? Now, this is a fascinating subject. We were hearing on Wednesday about the breastplate of righteousness by which the heart is protected from assaults by the enemy of souls. Is it not great to think that the Lord keeps a perfect balance between the righteous lives of his saints and the threats and dangers of assault on them which evil men enjoy making? Because, you see, these evil men are mad at genuine righteousness and love to drag it down because of their fierce hatred of all purity and truth and honesty. But the Lord weighs all hearts, and he who weighs all hearts is the perfect balancer. And he sees to it that his own are protected from their enemies according to the quality of their righteous lives. A new thought therefore occurred to me in thinking about that. And it was that to the degree that we deviate from the path of righteousness, we weaken God's hand. As far as our protection is concerned, had you thought of that? Weakening God's hand?
Sin interferes with God's good works. Because for us to indulge in any unrighteous conduct is to lean toward the enemy. And since the Lord cannot ever side with the enemy, to that extent, Satan is given leeway and purchase and power to do us harm. And God can't do a thing. It's a fearful thought. What could God do with Judas? What could our Lord Jesus do with him, who was with him for 3 whole years? Jesus was powerless to save Judas, because Judas sinned so grievously and heinously that he gave himself into the hands of Satan. And as we were hearing the other evening on Wednesday, when Judas left the upper room that fateful night, Satan personally entered into him and took possession of him, so that God had no alternative but to consign Judas to eternal hell. On the other hand, David, when he came to the throne, was able by God's power to subdue all his surrounding enemies. So that when Solomon came to the throne, the world was probably, listen to this, 1000 BC, round date, 1000 BC, the world was probably more peaceful during David and Solomon's reign as far as the war and strife of nations was concerned than at any other time in the whole of history. Talk about a watershed. Not much wonder, though, Solomon was given the name which means peace. It was singularly appropriate to give him that name, and of course it matched the name of the holy city, Jerusalem, which is not so different from Solomon. However, as soon as David in later life began to sin, why do godly men begin to sin in their old age? As soon as David in later life began to sin, things went wrong in the kingdom. And his own son Absalom, whom he worshipped, Absalom who should never have been, Absalom arose to queer David's pitch and drive his father from his throne. But with Absalom's death, which had to come, of course, and David's repentance, the evil results were contained within the kingdom. But David was virtually disqualified. Do you know the history of David? Oh, we'll need to go into it sometime. Fascinating history. David, after that, was virtually disqualified from doing any good work from that time until his death because of his sin with Bathsheba. Did you know that? Read the history. Have a look at this before you sleep tonight. The history of David in 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles to see how true what I say is. Nonetheless, although these evil effects were contained and subdued during the early years of Solomon's wise reign, as soon as Solomon's success and prosperity went to his head, or rather, if I may say so, almost cynically, went to other areas of his flesh. As soon as success and prosperity came to him, as prosperity can so easily do and lead to the indulgence of the flesh, watch it. And Solomon began to sin
as his father had done, Bathsheba and all that. For Solomon, you see, sought a phenomenal number and variety of women for a man who should have known the seventh commandment. Certainly he sought women far more than he sought his God. Then the surrounding enemies, until then kept down by the comparative righteousness of David and Solomon, the surrounding enemies began to stir. And this went on sporadically, but increasingly, as we know, during the whole checkered history of the monarchy, until greater enemies than Israel's and Judah's neighbors came on the scene. They first threatened, as Assyria did time and time again in Isaiah's day. But later, due to the persistent sinning of the sons and grandson of good King Josiah, a greater enemy came. A greater enemy came all the way from Babylon and destroyed the holy city and dragged most of its choicest inhabitants away to prison in Babylon. And when you get the next issue of the Daily Bible Readings into your hands, if you look at them, do I spend innumerable hours of my life on these only for people first of Aberdeen to read them or to admit that they read them? At least they are almost the only ones who ever acknowledge that they read them. And I find that my brother ministers who constantly write daily Bible reading notes, say the only ones who never take the slightest notice of them are the congregation at home. Others are grateful. If you look at them, you will see that this great enemy, Nebuchadnezzar, who lasted only the comparatively short space of 43 years, was so powerful that the great, ancient, fabulously wealthy city of Tyre was destroyed by him after a siege of 13 years. Judah was devastated and Jerusalem razed to the ground, temple and all. And as far as Egypt, a long way from Babylon, Egypt and all her satellites were overrun and defeated as far away into Africa as Ethiopia. Think of it. The ruination of Israel and Judah began in the sexual flesh of her two most illustrious kings, David and Solomon. That's the plain truth about the downfall of Israel and Judah. Nothing else. Just that. Their sexual flesh. It reminds us, harping on the negative side of that perceptive verse 7, about the Lord making a man's enemies live at peace with him when his ways are pleasing to the Lord, that as James Packer has said about his latest book on a passion for holiness, that there is nothing that the world is in such great need of as the holiness of Christians. The holiness of Christians, he says. The world is in greater need of the holiness of Christians than of anything else in the whole wide world. I do hope John Major emerges from this slur triumphantly.
It could mean more for this country after such as the Parkinson and the Miller and the Profumo affairs. It could mean more for this country than people may realize. It was our friend, the late Colonel Robert Thompson, who at the heart of government for many years, during and after the Second World War, came to visit us here because he found our record in the down on the Clyde Coast. What's the name of the down? Doesn't matter. It was he who said, and he was at the heart of government in the Foreign Office, that in his day there were few men at the head of affairs whose private lives could bear close scrutiny. And I still think, and I want you to pray about this, we were praying about it last night and this morning, church, I still think the only hope of the Prince of Wales, and maybe the monarchy itself, if all this is true of him, the only hope is that he should make a public confession of repentance. Don't you think that to go no further, that would please his mother? It would not only, as I've said before here, it would not only be the best thing he ever did, but it would shake the sinful, rotten, unfaithful world of our nation to the core. It might incline others to do the same, and might even lead to the revival we keep crying for. What do you think about that?